From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is lashing out again today on Twitter against the Russia investigation. He tweeted this morning, "This is a terrible situation, and Attorney General Jeff Sessions should stop this rigged witch hunt right now before it continues to stain our country any further. Bob Mueller is totally conflicted, and his 17 angry Democrats that are doing his dirty work are a disgrace to USA." Joining us now is Malcolm Nance. He's a former career intelligence officer and the author of the new book, The Plot to Destroy Democracy, How Putin's Spies Are Winning Control of America and Dismantling the West. Malcolm, strong words from the president there. He's not been a fan of the Mueller probe for a long time, but now he's telling his attorney general to shut it down.
You know, in the intelligence community, for people who deal in this sort of thing when they're going after third world potentates and dictators, Saddam Hussein, Muammar Gaddafi, we have a phrase for when their behavior, for when they don't know how the Americans are getting information that is damaging their regime. And it's called being buggy. And being buggy means that they sort of run around and start executing their staff in an effort to explain why the things that are happening to them are happening that are out of their control. And I'm afraid to say Donald Trump is being extremely buggy here. And this sounds like a warning shot to Jeff Sessions. And Jeff Sessions knows that if he does anything even remotely close to this, then that's, you know, Robert Mueller is going to be the least of his problems. You can get rid of Mueller, but you can't get rid of the law.
So do you think that Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, will listen to the president and do what he says or just ignore this as just more rhetoric on Twitter?
I think it's become pretty clear that over the last year that despite some of his rhetoric, Sessions wants to do the job of the attorney general within the confines of the law. Despite the fact that you have Rudy Giuliani and others trying to convince the president that the president is essentially above the law and that he has the right to fire people at his pleasure, well, you know, there are parameters to that, too, which can't be violated. And Jeff Sessions knows where those lines are.
Let's turn to the news from Facebook about what is going on now about interference in our election in 2018. The company said yesterday that it took down 32 accounts from Facebook and Instagram that appeared fake. They wouldn't actually say whether it was the Russians this time who are responsible. But what do you make of this news? And do you think it is the Russians?
Well, I absolutely believe it's the Russians. And there's many indications for that. I mean, this is really old KGB style propaganda and information warfare tactics, which now have only met the technology that could really make them work. But what's noteworthy about this particular attack, and I call it an attack, these things are viral vectors. It's like injecting a nerve agent into your body, right? One drop is enough to get you ill. But it relies on the Americans that would see this information to transmit it and propagate it across the entirety of the information warfare domain, which is called the news. And as it gets into the minds of people, it corrupts those minds. So what we saw here, certainly last year for the election, I'm sorry, the year before for the election, was the mindset of the American public is what's being hacked. And it's a Russian strategic military doctrine called hybrid warfare, where they take down countries by changing your opinion on fundamental things that are true and making you believe they are not true. And so by this Facebook plot appears that they were going to create fake, quote unquote, liberal and left extremist groups, turn them into these weapon systems, and then release that information to the far right and create a racial divide, I think, that we hadn't seen before. We saw some of these little tricks during the 2016 election. They had tried to weaponize this innocent group in southern Florida called the Black Fist Martial Arts and were trying to make it appear that they were this militant organization that was going to go out and fight whites. That was a test run. Clearly, they had stepped up their game and they had reached at the beginning, 290,000 Facebook subscribers.
Right, on one account. But what about the fact that it was only 32 accounts that Facebook got rid of? I have to think there are more than that trying to interfere in the election this time.
Yeah, and you only have to have one vector, one page, one post get out there that's popular, even though it is a blatant, outright lie. And then social media will do the rest. It acts like, you know, a dissemination system, which, you know, as Mark Twain puts it, right? You know, the truth is barely getting out of bed and putting on its shoes before the lie has traveled all the way around the world. The Russian system relies on that, and so do the American allies in this country who know that this is false. They know that this is going to benefit their candidate or their individual, and they publish those lies anyway.
Malcolm Nance, is the U.S. going to do enough to stop this from happening? The U.S. government, not Facebook, but the government.
Let me split government into two parts. The Trump administration, absolutely not. They fired the cybersecurity command, the manager at the White House. The Department of Homeland Security hasn't really been given any orders whatsoever to do the public-private partnership and awareness that people would need to know. But on the other side, you have the Department of Defense and other agencies and their IT managers. Yes, they are going to do whatever it takes to keep the country safe within the mandate of their organizations. So outside of that mandate, they can't do more without orders from the president, from the Secretary of Defense. And I suspect General Mattis will put as much resources as he has on alert, but I don't expect anybody above that in the senior executive level at the White House, because they have orders essentially from the president, which are, it's a hoax, it doesn't exist, and if something doesn't exist, they don't want to see any action taken on imaginary subjects.
That's Malcolm Nance, a former career intelligence officer. His new book is The Plot to Destroy Democracy, How Putin Spies Are Winning Control of America and Dismantling the West. Malcolm, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
Well, you may have heard ads for IBM's supercomputer Watson, lauded as a tool to revolutionize cancer treatment by personalizing it.
Excuse me, doctor. The genomic data came in.
Thank you.
You can do that kind of analysis.
Yeah, Watson.
I can.
But internal IBM documents show that company medical specialists knew that some of Watson's recommendations were actually unsafe, including incorrect treatments. Stat News reporter Casey Ross writes about the documents. And Casey, this is stunning. One oncologist from Jupiter Medical Center in Florida is quoted as saying, "This product is a piece of blank." What was Watson supposed to do with cancer treatment, and what's the criticism?
Well, what Watson was designed to do was to give practicing oncologists recommendations at the point of care to treat patients who are in front of them. And according to IBM, at least in its marketing, these recommendations were supposed to be based on its analysis of real patient data. These internal documents that we reviewed found, in fact, that that was not the case. The way the system was trained was hypothetical scenarios and recommendations were being fed into it by doctors at Memorial Sloan Kettering, who were basically inputting their own preferences for treatment. Doctors on the other end of that who were using the system were finding that the recommendations just were not very valuable or relevant in the care of the patients.
Or in some cases, it looks like in your writing, they could have been harmful. One patient who was hemorrhaging, who was bleeding, Watson recommended a medication that you're not supposed to give when somebody's bleeding.
In some cases, the recommendations that were put out through the system were inaccurate, had no foundation in clinical guidelines, and in some cases were found to be unsafe or dangerous to patients.
Yeah. Well, you've been reporting on problems since last September, saying, you know, you were hearing that Watson wasn't living up to expectations. Now you're reporting that IBM knew, didn't disclose problems. What does IBM say?
IBM continues to sort of toe this company line that they've built this product, that it's successful, that it is helping patients, that they have been able to sell it to hospitals around the world that are using it. But still, the adoption remains slow. In another internal conference call that we were able to review, they also just said that they did not meet their revenue targets for Watson for Oncology. So there is a gap between what they're saying publicly and what they're saying privately.
Well, you also report that there's research around IBM maybe partnering with another technology, a combined technology that might, you know, have better luck. But has anybody died from this or had a negative outcome from Watson's recommendations?
That we know nobody has been harmed as a result of the recommendations. Watson gives recommendations, and they're designed to be used in concert with a physician who would consider them and decide whether or not to put them in place for a patient. So we don't have any evidence that as a result of any of its recommendations, a physician has been led down the wrong path and given a patient treatment that's been harmful. Mm-hmm. But what's clear is that in the case of the use of this technology, IBM is essentially experimenting with it in real time. It has not been validated to the extent that I think a lot of doctors around the world want it to be, to show that it is, you know, both useful, relevant, and accurate. And I think that's disquieting to a lot of physicians.
Well, and to many patients.
And to many patients.
Yeah. So patients and doctors, beware. Stat reporter Casey Ross, will link you to his reporting at herenow.org. Casey, thanks.
Thanks very much for having me.
Yesterday, we spoke with Pakistani board game designer Nashra Balagamwala, who created a board game arranged to explain arranged marriages. Arranged marriages aren't forced marriages. The couples have choice. But the idea of aunties trying to pair her up was not for Nashra, so she avoided it, darkening her skin because lighter-skinned women were more preferable. She told us women who used tampons were seen as impure. To many listeners, it seemed patriarchal, racist, elitist. So why do almost 75% of young people in India want an arranged marriage? Why do many women in this country as well see it as freeing? Amy Bhattacharya is from New Jersey. She's of Indian descent. She's been in an arranged marriage for 15 years. Amy, this isn't something your parents did or even talked about until after you dated a while. What happened?
I was 23 at the time, and my mom approached me one day, and I was curious, and I met the candidate, and it just worked out.
Now, you knew that you could say no.
Yes.
And over how many days did you decide it was yes?
Well, at the time, I was living in New York City, and my husband was in Kentucky, and it was just a series of phone conversations, and then he came to my parents' place in Baltimore to meet me. And within a few months, it was pretty much decided that we would get married.
Wow. So how's it going?
Like any other marriage.
Well, so in other words, ups and downs, but you're in it.
Yes.
Well, you did traditional dating in high school and college. Did it just not work?
I just didn't feel like any person I was dating was taking me seriously. So this just seemed a lot more secure to me.
Well, yeah, that's a word that's often used, security. And we're reading a psychologist's take on this in Psychology Today. And he says one of the, you know, reasons that arranged marriages work is that it's somebody that you have met through someone you already trust.
Yes. Well, also, I feel the person comes with the intent of settling down. After that point, you just have to kind of make sure you're compatible and you have trust.
Well, I'm wondering, too, if one of the issues that you also got rid of was this idea of sometimes choice, and especially with all the online dating there is now, can be overwhelming. In fact, it's a mathematician, Chris McKinley, who created OkCupid. And sometimes people get overwhelmed. How many potential partners am I supposed to look at before I know? And he says There's actually a math equation for that. He decides when enough is enough. But was that a part of it for you?
Yeah, for sure. There's so many choices. And how can you tell by someone's picture? I don't really know how people filter through that.
So what do you say to people when they find out and they question, you know, you didn't get a chance to fall in love?
You know, marriage is a long journey, and a lot of things can happen after the actual wedding. So I guess I had faith that all the feelings would come to us after the wedding, as they have.
Are you saying you actually fell in love after your wedding?
I mean, there was an attraction, but yes, all of that happened as we started to grow as a family and, you know, go through life, of course. It's an evolving relationship.
Wow. And were you ever nervous as to whether or not you would? What if you didn't fall in love?
No, I'm quite reckless. I just trusted my gut and I went for it, so...
That's so funny that you would think of an arranged marriage as reckless, you know, because some people think of constant dating as reckless. You had a very different experience than many Indians in arranged marriages have, because as we understand from the board game, there are certain things a young woman cannot do if she wants to be successful in an arranged marriage. She can't get too much sun and darken her skin. She can't. I mean, you're laughing. Why?
Depending on the family. My family is not like that. In fact, my dad's family is atheist and pretty radical, and those do not apply.
What do your kids think about it? I mean, you know, kids want to know, how did mommy and daddy meet?
So my son is 10 and my daughter is 5. I can tell my son is a little curious about it. He does ask about how we met, and we tell him, you know, Baba came to your grandma's house and we met, and then we got married the next year. So I think there will be more questions to come, and hopefully he'll understand why we did what we did and have appreciation for it.
Well, it sounds as if you can tell them, and we fell in love and then fell deeper in love because of you. One other thing, this Psychology Today article points out that because people don't know each other all that well in arranged marriages, expectations are lower. Is that going too deep for you, or is that something that resonates for you?
No, it's definitely a lot. You know, people ask me about that aspect a lot. You know, there's different kinds of, there's expectations from your husband and there's expectations for what you had envisioned your life to be. But with age and with years, that perspective changes. And I think when two people have intentions of being together and having a family and making it work, they change themselves, they work hard, and things work out. I mean, it's not easy, but they make it work. So expectations change as well.
That's Amy Bhattacharya, who has been in an arranged marriage for 15 years. She lives in New Jersey. Amy, thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's bring in Dr. Robert Epstein, former editor-in-chief of Psychology Today and a researcher at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology in San Diego. He has studied arranged marriages around the world, spoken about them before audiences of thousands of women, including Maria Shriver's The Women's Conference in California, very independent women who were very receptive to his message that there's much to learn from people who grow into love. Dr. Epstein, why did you start researching this?
Because people actually do that. People who barely know each other, maybe more than half the marriages in the world, they're brought together and they get married and then they get to know each other and they gradually build love over time.
Well, it was interesting to us because here you are an editor at Psychology Today, and some of the articles there were what drove our conversations. One titled, Why Are So Many Indian Arranged Marriages Successful? This was by a Dr. Uptal Delakia from Rice University. It turns out there's research that shows that the more you know someone, the higher expectations you have of them, or the more you research, let's say, even buying a piece of IKEA furniture, the higher expectation you have of whether you're going to like it. What did you find in your research?
I've been interviewing and studying people from, I think, 12 different countries, 6 different religions. And the answer is, well, it kind of depends. But yes, people go into it barely knowing each other, very low expectations. But the families typically have brought them together, believing that they're well-suited, wanting things to work out, being very, very supportive of the relationship. And what I've learned is that people actually can deliberately not only get to know each other, but actually build love over time. I mean, it's incredible. I was interviewing a very well-educated woman in Pakistan. We got to that part of the interview where I said, on the day you were married, on a scale of 1 to 10, how in love were you with this man on that day? And she said, 0. And I said, and how in love are you with him now? And she said, 11. And I said, and how long have you been married? And she said, 45 years. That's a whole different way of thinking. It's a different trajectory. We leave everything to chance. In many cultures, they don't.
Why else do you think they work? Because some people have compared them to online marriages. It's just that instead of the aunties running around trying to match you up, you have an algorithm.
They work for all kinds of reasons. One is there's so much family support. The families are bringing those people together not to make them miserable. They're bringing them together because they want that relationship to work and they believe it will work. And these professional matchmakers, again, they have that same motivation. So, you know, you've got societal support, you've got family support. These arranged marriages often work extremely well.
Well, in fact, you point to research again that marriages that start with love, the love often erodes and weakens over time. But as you said, an arranged marriage, maybe there's zero love in the beginning, but it grows. And you tried an experiment with students, if I've got this right, where you asked them to pair off into couples and look into each other's eyes. What happened there?
Oh, yes. I've done this a number of times where I have people do 2 minutes of soul gazing, just looking into each other's eyes, trying to reach into the other person's soul. And, you know, we get numbers before and after the exercise to see how much they like each other, trust each other, love each other. And all of the numbers go up with total strangers after just 2 minutes of soul gazing. And the numbers can really jump. I mean, on a scale of 1 to 10, they can go from 0 to 5, 0 to 6.
Yeah, in other words, you've asked someone beforehand, do you like this person? And they're like, not really. And then you have them in 2 minutes. You can get them to like each other by looking in each other's eyes.
Well, yes. And in fact, that's really what turns out is the key to understanding how love grows in many arranged marriages. The key is vulnerability, because in many arranged marriages, people make themselves the most vulnerable you could possibly be. And that means they make a lifetime, a serious lifetime commitment that's supported by the families. And the more, you know, seriously you are committed to someone, well, think about it, the more vulnerable you are to being hurt. Vulnerability is the key. Simple exercises can make you and another person feel more vulnerable to each other, and that increases an emotional bond, and over time that can lead to very deep love.
Dr. Robert Epstein, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. It's a pleasure.
Regardless of where you live in America and when your people came, odds are someone was there before you. But who? Well, now there's an app where you can find out. It started with one goal: help right the wrongs of injustice experienced by indigenous people. Emily Schwing from the Northwest News Network has more.
Victor Temprano grew up in Canada, but he's not native. And so he says he didn't really know much about the experience of First Nations people who also live where he does in Vancouver, British Columbia.
So I never learned about things like residential schools or things about the Indian Act or the banning of certain ceremonies and these kinds of things. And it infuriated me first that I didn't know about it. And then it was kind of shocking because I realized that so many people I knew didn't really know about it.
3 years ago, the web developer sat down to create an app.
It's just a mapping tool that attempts to map Indigenous territories, languages, and treaties across originally North America and increasingly South America and the world.
When I zoom in, I can see this patchwork of colors.
I asked my Northwest News Network colleagues to sign on to Temprano's app. It's called Native Land. Anna King lives and works in Southeast Washington.
That are all indicating all of the territories or language blocks or treaty areas. Where I live, there is the Spokane, the Cayuse, the Nez Perce, the Umatilla, the Yakima, the Tenino are all surrounding the area that I live.
I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia. Tap in 98501, the zip code.
And that's how this app works. You simply pull up the website, nativeland.ca, type in your zip code, hit enter,
and it zooms in. Says I'm on the land of the Puget Sound Salish, which makes sense, although I'm not sure how useful that is in modern times. I think of my neighbors as Nisqually, Squaxin Island, and Chehalis tribes.
The information in the app comes from at least 65 different sources available online.
The source quality varies hugely between the different territories, and sometimes the names may be incorrect, or they may be old colonial names, or maybe entire areas or entire polygons that have drawn with certain groups might be in the wrong place.
Because of that mashup, Victor Temprano is also critical of his work.
I'm suspicious of a lot of what's going on under the surface of such an application, because it's quite easy to just look at something that someone put online and take it as fact.
Land is complicated.
Lena Menifee is a member of the Kitkatla Nation with territory along the coast of northern British Columbia. She's a member of the board of directors guiding Temprano through development of the Native Land app.
This is an entry point to realize, like, oh, there is a protocol. There is a way that people acknowledge when they go into other territories, and I can actually replicate that or imitate that, so I'm not being rude when I go into somebody's territory or house.
The app also includes information about Indigenous people in Australia, New Zealand, Greenland, and areas throughout Central and South America. Victor Temprano says he'd like to see the app expand to include Indigenous place names and to show how people have moved and migrated across landscapes. For Here and Now, I'm Emily Schwing on the traditional homeland of the Tanaha, Ponderay, Spokane, and Coeur d'Alene tribes.
San Francisco has a trash problem. Earlier this summer, a large medical convention predicted to bring in $40 million worth of business backed out of choosing San Francisco as its host, citing dirty streets increasingly filled with needles, trash, and human feces. Here's San Francisco Mayor London Breed speaking with local NBC4.
I will say that there's more feces on the sidewalks than I've ever seen, you know, growing up here. That was something that wasn't the norm.
Mayor Breed has called for more funding for street cleaning and for safe injection sites to clear the streets of drug users and needles. Mohammed Nuru is Public Works Director for the City of San Francisco. He joins us now. Mohammed, welcome.
Thank you.
And at least one infectious disease expert has looked at the conditions in San Francisco and compares it to some of the dirtiest slums in the world. Is it really that bad?
It's definitely challenging times. You know, the city, the communities, and everyone, we're all working hard to address those challenges that we're facing.
What are you seeing there? Give us a sense of what the trash levels are like. And is it all over the city or just in one place?
In general, it is in the concentrated areas like the Tenderloin, the south of Market, and a little bit of in the Mission area. But all over the city, we are seeing people moving, you know, into other neighborhoods. And we're facing those challenges of trying to keep the city clean.
You're talking about homeless people moving into other neighborhoods?
Yes, sir.
I mean, how much is this tied to the homeless population in San Francisco?
Quite a bit. I mean, our resources have been focused on really trying to clean up areas that mostly have been trashed by homeless, had tents where people were living in them, people were using the streets for the bathroom, people did not have trash service, and, you know, it creates definitely a different problem. When the guys come to work, they're always diverted to address these problems before they get to go on what their regular routes will be.
It seems, though, like rather than criminalizing this behavior on the part of the homeless, the mayor simply wants nonprofit organizations that work with the homeless to try to get people to clean up after themselves.
You know, I would agree with the mayor. I think it's time for tough love. The city combined cannot do this job alone. And the nonprofits, the property owners, the businesses, we all need to focus on this problem. And that's what we're working towards, really trying to get the information so we're in the right places at the right time. We have set up what's called the Healthy Streets Operations Center. It's like a command center where we have the police department, the health department, our homeless office, public works. And we're monitoring all those locations and trying to respond as fast as we can.
How much more are you having to spend in terms of money and time dealing with this issue of the streets?
In the last few years, we have been given quite a bit of more money. Our budget was in the range of about $40 million, and now we have over $50 million. So that additional $10 million has just come in the last few years.
What do you have to do? Is it just about power washing the sidewalks, sending people around to pick up trash and in some cases, feces?
It's a little bit more complicated than just picking up trash or cleaning up feces. I think, you know, we're working with our sister agencies to make sure that we have the appropriate places to take people who are living on the streets. And so we have these navigation centers, a place where people are being brought to, and they are being provided services and being, you know, helped where they need to go. Because if we don't have a place to take people to, then it becomes harder to get people to leave the streets. And many of these guys have been here on the streets for a while. And so, you know, it's not the same as it used to be, where you can just go across the street or go into another neighborhood. We're focused on the whole city, and we're going to really try and get you into services so that we can address the concerns of cleanliness on our streets.
I'm sure that there are going to be some people who hear this, hear what's going on in San Francisco, and say, well, the reason that you have such a homeless problem there is because it's gotten so expensive to live in San Francisco. Is that the case? Is that part of what's going on? Or is this just a homeless population that has been there all along and they're just causing more trouble for the city now?
Well, I think it's a combination of things that have happened. I mean, our city is growing pretty fast. And so many of the vacant lots or many of the open spaces are now being developed. Probably at one time, there were people who were actually living on some of those areas. And so the little pushing here and there, I think, has added to people being out on our streets. City is a little expensive, but, you know, we're just trying to deal with the population out there.
Do you feel like you have more of a burden when it comes to the homeless population than other major cities?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, our city has been a magnet for providing services. And so, you know, a larger number of the people we see on our streets are not necessarily from San Francisco. They are coming from surrounding counties and in some cases even from across state lines.
Do you think that the city provides too much, that you're actually creating, as you say, a magnet for people to come to San Francisco if they're homeless?
Well, I mean, San Francisco is a city that cares, and San Francisco is a city that wants to really take care of, you know, those who are within our city limits. And so, you know, we just have to have a system that works. I know compared to many other cities, we're doing quite a, you know, a good job, but we're not there. And so we just have to plan for, you know, exactly what we see. We have several thousand people who are on the streets. We have people who are criminals who are mixed in those people. And we have people who actually can do things for themselves, like, you know, being able to provide them a job or being able to find some kind of temporary housing to get them off the streets. And so it's a huge problem, but we're tackling it, you know, day by day. We definitely feel we're making progress. I think several months ago, we had large encampments on our streets. We are down to much smaller encampments now. We're trying to hold the line and really, you know, just, you know, giving that tough love to people and telling them, you know, there's a zero tolerance for people being on the streets, and trying to provide the services that are needed so that people can, you know, can be in the right place.
Mm-hmm. Now, we mentioned the medical convention that has backed out of choosing San Francisco to host its event because of the street conditions there. Is that just a one-off thing, or do you think that that's happening more now, that the city will actually lose business because of the conditions?
Well, I mean, we have been working with the convention staff and the people who book these conventions and, you know, our tourist industry, and really trying to address the concerns. I would hope that this is just a short-term type of concern, and that we can really get our city to what it should be, a nice, clean destination for people who want to come out to the West Coast. And we're working towards that. We've heard some of their concerns. We've heard cleanliness being one of the top priorities. We've also heard cost being a high priority. And so, you know, just like a village, it takes everyone to get together to try and solve a problem. And every day we're at the drawing board trying to make our city a better place for people to live.
I have to say, as an outsider who doesn't live in San Francisco, I think of it as one of the most beautiful cities in the world. It's kind of unbelievable to think that it would be in such a state that we were hearing about in the news.
Well, I mean, you know, I think, you know, I mean, we're talking about San Francisco, and yes, we're a destination city, but I can tell you, you know, other cities like Los Angeles, Seattle, I mean, are really struggling with the same problem. And so, you know, we hear from them. We have launched so many different programs. You know, our Pit Stop program is one that has taken off, which is provides bathrooms and places for people to use the bathroom as opposed to the streets. I mean, we're talking about having, you know, crews that are roving around now looking for areas that need cleaning so that we can just keep the city clean. We're working very hard with our police department to begin to really focus on quality of life types of concerns. And we're building more navigation centers and places for people to be able to go so that, you know, it's well-staffed and they get the right treatment. And yes, we are forming those partnerships with many of the nonprofits. They do receive quite a bit of funding from the city, and it's going to take all of us to really, you know, get the city back to what it should be.
That's Mohammed Nuru, who is Director of Public Works for the City of San Francisco. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Today, President Trump tweeted out a question. To paraphrase, he said, why is former campaign chair Paul Manafort on trial for conspiracy to evade tax and banking laws being treated worse than mobster Al Capone, who was convicted of tax evasion but was also a killer? The president said Manafort is in solitary confinement during his trial, but he is not. It's pretty remarkable for a president to comment during a federal trial, and this one is just in day two. Prosecutors say Manafort orchestrated a conspiracy to evade U.S. tax and banking laws and hide millions of dollars he was paid as a lobbyist for the then Russian-backed Ukrainian government. The Russia investigation is not expected to be part of this trial, but this is the first trial to come from Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. NPR's Ryan Lucas joins us from a break during the proceedings. So, Ryan, thank you.
My pleasure.
And in his opening statements, Manafort's attorney focused on Manafort's business partner, Rick Gates, who's already pled guilty to conspiracy and lying to the FBI. He's cooperating with Robert Mueller. And Manafort's defense is blaming Rick Gates. So what did we hear today?
Well, we heard from two witnesses so far today. One is a man by the name of Daniel Rabin, who is a political consultant who worked with Manafort in Ukraine for several years. He talked a lot about Manafort and his management style. He said that Manafort demanded a lot of people who worked for him, that he was very thorough. And he was very strict. But he also added that he was a good consultant who worked for the best of the campaign that he was working for. This is something that we've heard from, elicited from questions directed at witnesses by prosecutors, trying to basically prove or provide evidence that Manafort was indeed a very hands-on boss. And he was not somebody whose trust was abused, as the defense has said in its opening statements.
By Rick Gates. Well, and what about Rick Gates? Might he, you know, there's been speculation that there would be this very fiery moment when Rick Gates might take the stand.
That's right. Rick Gates was listed as one of the 35 or so potential witnesses. At one point during today's proceedings, prosecutors said that they may or may not call Gates in to testify. That sent a number of journalists in the courtroom scurrying out. But prosecutors also cautioned that they always kind of recalculate as the trial goes on who exactly they want to bring in to have testify or not, depending on how the trial is going, how much time there is. So there are a lot of calculations that go into that, and they caution not to read too much into that statement.
Yeah. Look, in the opening statements, the government lawyers said Manafort made millions as this political consultant to Ukraine's former president after he was thrown out by Ukrainians. Putin annexed Crimea. Manafort later joined the Trump campaign. As I said, the Russia investigation isn't supposed to, you know, be brought up here. This is about conspiracy and, you know, shell companies and hiding money. But what's the sense of what's really happening here? Is there a sense here that this is about Robert Mueller squeezing Paul Manafort so that he will? I mean, at any moment, we understand, during this trial, he can just say, I give. I want to cooperate with the investigation.
Well, two things. First, the question of Russia has not come up in this trial so far, and it is unlikely to. Yes, it's a trial that is focusing on alleged bank and tax fraud perpetrated by Manafort from about 2005 to 2015. But yes, there is speculation that a lot of this the case against Manafort is perhaps an attempt by the special counsel to squeeze Manafort and get him to cooperate and provide evidence against or testimony against the president. But That is speculation. What we know for sure are the charges that Manafort has been hit with, and he is fighting those charges thus far.
Yeah. And how does he seem in the courtroom?
He's been he was actually very involved during jury selection yesterday, consulting with his lawyers. Since then, he's looked fairly relaxed when he's come in. He is wearing a dark suit today with a burgundy tie. Fairly composed, fairly relaxed. I mean, he's somebody who's used to dealing with high stakes things. So he's not looking like somebody who's sweating it right now.
Yeah. There's also speculation that the president could pardon him at any moment. Can he pardon him during the trial?
Well, I think that getting into speculation as to whether the president will or won't pardon Paul Manafort at this point is a little premature. I think we have to wait and see how this trial plays out. What the president ultimately decides to do is obviously something that, that's a decision that the president is going to make when and if he makes it.
Yeah. As you look forward to, we have about a minute here, look forward to the afternoon and what's ahead. What are you waiting for?
Well, we had an FBI special agent who was involved in the search warrant that was executed on Manafort's residence here in Alexandria this morning. So we went through a number of documents that were seized in that raid this morning. This afternoon, we have a couple of other witnesses who had business dealings with Manafort. And we'll just have to wait and see what the story that the government is trying to tell and create.
NPR's Ryan Lucas in Alexandria, Virginia, covering the former Trump campaign chair, Paul Manafort's trial. Thank you.
Thank you.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.